We're going to read Isaiah chapter 6 today. We're on continuing with our Isaiah series, and each of you has a little handout with a sheet of paper there, and it's got those three towers or bars. And the idea is that these three themes, judgment, comfort and hope, are present in all through Isaiah, but in some parts one of those or two of those are emphasised more than the other part. And so what we want you to do as I read through, or when I finish reading Isaiah 6 today, I want you to fill in the bars. So if you think it's all about judgment, fill in the bar on the left all the way to the top. And if you think there's nothing about hope, just leave that one blank, or maybe put the little blank at the bottom. If you think it's somewhere in the middle, or there's a couple of them that are about the same, in terms of the emphasis of those themes in this passage, have a go at doing that. Does that sound okay? No, it's the whole passage. So listen to the whole passage and then think, yes, there's some bits in there that were focused on judgment, there's bits in there focused on comfort, there's bits in there focused on hope, and try and make an assessment out of them, which one you think it was like the strongest. Does that sound okay? Excellent. So what you might like to do is I'm going to read this passage, and I want you to try and imagine you're there with Isaiah seeing what he saw. And whatever way helps you to enter into that a bit better, let's have a go at doing that. So Isaiah chapter 6. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord, high and exalted, seated on a throne, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him were seraphim, each with six wings. With two wings they covered their faces, and with two they covered their feet. And with two they were flying, and they were calling to one another, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty. The whole earth is full of his glory." At the sound of their voices, the doorposts and the threshold shook, and the temple was filled with smoke. "Woe is me! Woe to me!" I cried. "I am ruined. For I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips, and my eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty." Then one of the seraphim flew to me with a live coal in his hand, which he had taken with tongs from the altar. With it he touched my mouth and said, "See, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away and your sin atoned for." Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send, and who will go for us?" And I said, "Here am I. Send me." He said, "Go and tell his people, be ever hearing but never understanding, be ever seeing but never perceiving. Make the heart of this people calloused, make their ears dull and close their eyes. Otherwise they might see with their eyes, hear with their ears, understand with their hearts and turn and be healed." Then I said, "For how long, Lord?" And he answered, "Until the cities lie ruined and without inhabitant, until the houses are left deserted, and the fields ruined and ravaged, until the Lord has sent everyone far away, and the land is utterly forsaken. And though a tenth remains in the land, it will again be laid waste. But as the terebinth and oak leave stumps when they are cut down, so the holy seed will be the stump in the land." All right, have a go. Colouring your columns. Which themes do you think were the most present in that passage, and which themes do you think were least present in that passage? I won't be asking you to tell anybody. I won't be marking them. I won't be handing them in. That's okay. So just have your best stab at doing it. Excellent. I have a friend. That might be surprising to some of you, but I do have a friend. His name is Noel, and he's a minister, and he actually spoke at Sonnington many, many years ago. But he is a guy who I think proves time and time again that there is a God. And that's because whenever you get in the car with him to drive somewhere and you arrive somewhere at the other end alive, it's a miracle. The reason for that is he's got some really weird stuff going on with his eyes. Like, it's not just like short-sighted or long-sighted, but it's really distorted and all those sort of things. So I remember on one occasion that he went into Geelong, we were living in Drysdale,
He went into the Geelong and he went and got his eyes tested and got a new prescription for his glasses. I mean, they were thick and weird and all that sort of stuff. And he put them on, and then he was driving home and he said to his wife, said, "Wow, I can see stuff I've never seen before. Like there's stuff on the road, like there's lines, and there's, I can even see like the little, you know, gravelly bits and all that sort of stuff." And she's going, "Ah." "And I've been driving these how many years and you couldn't see any of that." Or maybe you yourself, or you know someone who's had cataract surgery, you know, and all of a sudden, "Oh, I didn't realise the world was so colourful. I can read things again," or whatever else it is. When we have eyes, an eye problem, and it gets fixed, we see things in a whole new light, don't we? And that's what's happened here for Isaiah. He's been able to see things in a whole new light. Now, he was lived in Jerusalem, and he was probably in the temple that was built during Solomon's reign, when Solomon was king, about 250 years before the time of Isaiah. And he was in the temple. And in the temple were all these things that had been built according to the specifications given by Moses back in Exodus. And this is where the altar was, and this is how the mercy seat was, and all these sort of things. And they were representative and, if you like, or models of what was actually like in heaven. They pointed to a reality beyond themselves. And in this moment, in this place, just like we are here today, gathered in a church building, he saw beyond the physical. Just like if you and I came in here this morning and all of a sudden there's a cross there and that reminds us about Jesus' death and resurrection, but in the worship or some other time, all of a sudden the eyes of our minds are open and we see beyond just the representation of it to the reality beyond it. And here in the beginning of this passage, Isaiah has a moment where his eyes are fixed, where he gets prescriptions, where his cataracts are taken away, and he can see God and the truth of God in a fundamentally new way for him, a life-changing way for him. He was in the place where they understood God to be. The temple was like God's residence on earth. And then he says, "I saw the Lord seated on a throne, and the train of his robe filled the temple." Now, when I was growing up, we sang a song that had "the train of his robe filled the temple," right? And I don't know whether you think about like a steam train, or an electric train, you know, a metro train. I don't know. Well, no, they wouldn't be on time, so they wouldn't be. They wouldn't be filling the temple. But I mean, I guess a confusing phrase, right? But so what it is, you know. The kings wear robes, right? And they big grand robes that sort of fall down to the ground. And it's a bit like the train of a bridal gown, right? The bottom of it, the hem of it, the last bit of it, right? And so here Isaiah, he's in the temple and he says, just the little edge bit of God's train fills the temple. Just an itty little bit of a garment that God's wearing fills this whole place. And Isaiah comes to a deep realization that God is much bigger than he ever imagined. God isn't just, we don't just come to the temple to meet with God in God's house. God is so big that barely a little thread of the end of his coat, of his cloak, filled this whole place. And this is in a time where people understood that every nation had their own gods and their gods were in their temples. And here all of a sudden there's this mind-blowing realization and revelation of the enormity of God. And then he sees these amazing fiery creatures who are so big and powerful in themselves that they cause the place to shake. They're not even God, but they're so impressive and amazing that they themselves cause the place to shake. And they say these remarkable words: "Holy, holy, holy, set apart, set apart, set apart, the most set apart, the most different to ordinary human beings is the Lord Almighty. The whole earth is full of his glory. The little bit of the robe fills the temple where Isaiah was. But now the whole earth is filled with the glory of God. You know, just the reflected radiance and goodness of God, not even God himself, just a little bit of God, God's glory fills the whole joint. God is massive. God's not a local deity. God's not small and insignificant. God is truly massive. The hem of his garment fills the whole house. His glory fills the whole earth, and that's not even God. And Isaiah's eyes have been fixed. The cataracts are gone. The prescription lenses are on. And he sees God truly in a way that he hadn't before. If you've been reading through Isaiah, this passage seems a bit strange. It's very personal, isn't it? I mean, it is, like last week when Paul talked in chapter 5, it's a message to the nation, and that's mainly the case all the way through. But here there's this really small personal account. Why is it there? Well, it's a bit like this. I don't know if anyone ever watched NCIS, that TV show. No, anyone watched NCIS? It's a drama. They're like an investigative Naval Criminal Investigation Service, I think is what it stands for. It's been going for 15 years. It's like a huge show all around the world. But it's very interesting. At the start of every show, the first thing that happens is some body is discovered. Some dead body is discovered. Right? And then it cuts away from the terrible scene of the dead body to the team gathering together and sharing some aspect of life. But in most shows, the thing that they're sharing in life, maybe it's someone's having a trouble with their mum, or they're preparing something for Christmas or Thanksgiving or some other thing. Some way, the theme that's going on in their lives is linked to the theme of the murder investigation. You've got the big picture of the murder investigation, and you've got the small thing of the drama in their lives, and they're parallel. They're parallel stories, and this is what's happening here. There's the parallel story. There's the story of what's happening in Israel or in Judah, and there's the story of what's happening in Isaiah's life, and they're linked. Isaiah, in his own life, is living out what Israel needs to live out. Last week, Paul talked about the woes, and Isaiah was delivering a message of woe is this, woe is that, woe to you for this, woe to you for that. But he'd already lived it himself. He'd said, woe to me. And so in the microcosm, he's living out what he wants, and he knows that Israel in the macro, or Judah in the macro, needs to do. Because when Isaiah gets this fresh revelation of God, when he understands God in a way that he hasn't before, he then understands himself in a way he hasn't before. He's gone to Specsavers. Because he's recognised the greatness of God, the grandness of God. God isn't just a little deity that looks after the nation of Israel. God's the God of the whole universe. And sometimes for us, because we know that God is with us in a personal way, we can think it's just me and God, and that's true. But sometimes we need to get our eyes lifted and our concepts busted open with, no, God's not just the God for me, but God for everybody. And he's concerned about my life, but he's not just concerned about my life. He's concerned about everybody's lives. And in the lightness of the goodness and the holiness and the otherness and the bigness of God, Isaiah realizes how inadequate his response to God has been. The things that he's said, the things that he's done. Woe to me, he cried, I am undone. I live among a people of unclean lips, and my eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty. And he was expecting to die. That's what they thought happened. When you saw God, you died. But instead, he's forgiven. The tong from the altar, your guilt is now taken away. Isaiah has this vision of God. He confesses his own sin and he receives God's cleansing. And that's what can happen in your life, in my life, where God somehow opens our eyes and we see God in a fresh way, the bigness of God in a fresh way, and the goodness and the purity and the wonderfulness of God in a fresh way. And in the light of that, we just see our own dirt. It's a bit like when you replace a light bulb in your house and all of a sudden you see all the dust that you didn't see before because there's now more light in the room. Or it's like if you take your carefully polished car out of the garage, not that I've ever done that, and then you see how on one side of it you're actually mispolishing and it's dirty and grimy and scratches and dents and all that sort of stuff, you know, in the light of the sun. When we see God as God is in fresh ways, we'll often be more acutely aware of our own shortcomings and failings. And that's okay. We need not be afraid of that, because it's not a death sentence. In fact, it's a life sentence. Because now God, we know what we need to have happen in our lives, and God can bring the forgiveness, God can bring the renewal, God can bring those other things into our lives that we actually now need. He always knew we needed, but we didn't know we needed them till we had this vision of God. So as we continue to reflect on this passage, just keep in your mind, is there some way in which I need to think about God in a fresh way? You might think, well, I've just got to wait till I get some vision like that. You know, when I'm in here on a Sunday service and instead of all of the people singing and preaching and all that sort of stuff, I'm just in raptures with the hem of his garment filling the whole house. Well, you and I don't need to have the same experience as Isaiah to come to the same understanding as Isaiah did. Now, you and I were not there when penicillin was first discovered. And I went, wow, penicillin's really good. But you and I can go and buy penicillin and have its benefits in our lives, even though we weren't there at the moment of discovery. You weren't there in the Coorong 10 years ago when I went and bought a book by Mike Breen. And, well, I picked it up on the shelf and read a third of it in the shop and thought, well, I should probably buy it now since I've read a third of it already. And it's the stuff about discipleship and mission that we've been trying to live out ever since. You don't need to have been in Coorong with me there to have the benefit of what we discovered through that process. And you and I don't need to have had the dramatic vision that Isaiah did to understand that God is so much bigger than we ever thought. So much more brilliant, so much more all-encompassing, powerful, holy, pure, whatever it is. So that we can then also recognise in our lives that our inadequacies, and to receive God's saving. It really is spec savers, right? We see God and then we're saved by God. You really should have gone to spec savers. And from this new place of understanding who God is, who we are, who we were, who by God's grace we are becoming. Now, dramatic opportunities open up. And just like for Isaiah, God says, who shall I send and who will go for us? And Isaiah says, pick me, pick me. Oh, yes, yes. You know, have you ever been in the classroom when you're a kid and they ask something and, oh, they're gonna, and you're sort of throwing your hand up in the air? Did you ever do that? Yeah. Some of you are obviously not like me. I'd go, pick me, pick me. Because all of a sudden we're living in a bigger reality. We're living in something more bigger than our own small little myopic lives. We're living life in connection with the King of the universe who fills everything with his glory, and the world is different now. And Isaiah doesn't even know what he's signing up for, but he says, yeah, I want to be part of that. Imagine you come to a person, you come into the presence of a person you really admire. Maybe it's the greatest train driver in the world, or maybe it's the greatest cook, or maybe the greatest artist, or whatever else area of your life that you just would honour. You would think that person is just fantastic because of their expertise and their fame or whatever else. And if they came to you and said, I want you to do something for me, Paul. Imagine Taylor Swift came to you, Paul, and said, I want you to do something for me, Paul. Are you up for it?
Here I am.
Welcome to New York.
Very nice.
But it's like that, isn't it? I mean, if you're in the presence of the person that you admire the most, you don't really care what it is. You just get the privilege of doing something with them and for them. And as we get a revelation of God, as we then understand our own imperfections but receive God's grace in fresh ways, then we're in a position to say, yes, God, pick me. Here I am. Send me. And then God gives Isaiah what seems like a bit of a bummer of a commission. No? Go and tell his people, be ever hearing but never understanding, be ever seeing but never perceiving, making the heart of the people callous, make their ears dull. And basically you're going to go and preach to people for the rest of your life. They're not going to listen to a word you're saying. Everything's going to be, come crashing down. It's all going to be destroyed. And how long do you have to do this? Basically forever. But Isaiah didn't care. He didn't care the content of his commission. He was just glad to be commissioned by the one he'd come to know in a deep and profound way. And it might have seemed like, initially, that Isaiah's ministry had no fruit. It might have seemed like it was a pointless and thankless exercise. But let me tell you, that the nation of Israel, after they went through exile and after they came back, they found the words of Isaiah so meaningful that they copied them and assembled them into this book that we have today. Well, let me tell you that Jesus, the very Son of God, grew up an Isaiah junkie. When Jesus started his public ministry, he referenced Isaiah. The Spirit of the Lord is on me. He has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. Jesus patterned himself on the way Isaiah spoke. In chapter 5 of Isaiah, Isaiah did a parable of the vineyard. Well, guess what? Jesus did a parable of the vineyard too. Isaiah used riddles and other words and parables, and that's what Jesus did. And in this passage that we're reading today, Jesus quoted this passage. When he was asked to explain one of his own parables, the parable of the sower, he said, I speak in parables so that people may be ever hearing but not understanding, ever seeing but not grasping. And although it may have seemed like Isaiah's ministry was a failure in his day, when he's sitting in heaven now, I think he would be humbly blown away that the Son of God used his words. And I think he'd be even more amazed to think that a guy called David, in a place called Chadston, 2,700 years later, is still reading about his life. I don't know what commission God will give you if you say, here, pick me. I don't know how outwardly successful otherwise it may be. But at the very least, the example of Isaiah is that we may never truly, really know the significance of what it is that God's called you to do. Isaiah shared this story because he wanted to be a pattern. He wanted to show the nation of Israel, you need to grasp who God is really like. You need to come to terms with what you're really like. You need to receive this grace from God, and then you need to embrace God's commission for your life as a nation. And so for us today, it's exactly the same. Individually, we need to understand how big and amazing God is. We need to be honest about how broken and sinful we are. We need to, with deep gratitude, embrace the grace and the forgiveness and the cleansing of God. And individually and as a group. And then wider, hopefully, as a city. And wider even yet as a nation. Out of this renewed understanding of who God is, say, here we are, send us to do the things that you've called us to do. We need to go to Specsavers. We need to have our understanding of who God is expanded and renewed. And as we become more aware of our own dirt in the light of God's brilliance, we need God's grace and forgiveness. But then we need to give away what we've found. Tell the world of the treasure we've found. So I think in this passage, judgment and comfort are the two main themes. There's a little bit of hope at the end for the nation of Israel. Everything's going to be destroyed, but all the trees are going to be cut down, but there is going to be something that comes out of one of the stumps. And although there's some pretty harsh words about who people are like, what Isaiah is like and what the people are like, there is also great comfort in the fact that God reveals himself to these people, reveals himself to broken and sinful and rebellious people. And when they become aware of their sinfulness and brokenness, he forgives and heals them. So Isaiah lived in his own life what he then spent the rest of his life calling Israel to. And we need to live in our own lives the reality of God so that then we can call other people to share in it with us. Let's pray. Lord, some of us have sung the song about train filling the temple, and others of us have puzzled over these words. But Lord, I pray that in this moment, these last moments together, or maybe sometime during this week, Lord, that the cataracts would be removed from our eyes. Lord, that the prescription glasses would be supplied, and we would see you clearly in ways we haven't seen you clearly for a long time. And Lord, that we would be able to be honest in the light of your glory and goodness, and humbly receive your mercy. But may what we discover about you, God, inspire us to say, pick me, send me, and give us the courage to be faithful in following through on the commissions you give us, however small or insignificant they may be. In Jesus' name. Amen.